Hello there. This is Eric Sinrod of Duane Morris with my colleague Jonathan Armstrong. We're bringing you your most recent installment of Tech Law 10, where the law intersects with information technology. And Jonathan, now that you're today in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital, because you're in Washington, you feel like you're qualified to talk about a case that recently came down in the other Washington, the Washington Western District of Washington, across the country in the Northwest. What do you want to tell us about this case, Jonathan?
Yeah, absolutely. You've got that spot on, Eric. Now that I've been in the country for almost 48 hours, I'm qualified to give advice on U.S. law. And but in this case, strangely, I do feel qualified because it seems to me that this is the case I'm talking about is one of the closest, I think, to an EU-type resolution of the case that I've seen, and I'm interested in your views on this. So for those of you who've missed it, the case is, and I'm sorry, I'm bound to pronounce this wrong, but Hoang against Amazon. We'll put it up on the LinkedIn so that you don't have to search for the case.
And it's actually spelled H-O-A-N-G, but I believe it's pronounced Huang. But go ahead.
Is it? Right. Well, then I'll defer to you on that and that alone. So basically, the person concerned is an actress. And she is featured on IMDb, the Internet Movie Database. Those of you who were with us last week will remember that we talked a little bit about Zoolander, so you'll know both of us like our films. And we use IMDb to find out, you know, locations, who's been in films, and so on and so on. And this particular actress was featured on IMDb, and she then subscribed to IMDb Pro, so as a, if you like, a super user of IMDb, and she did that to change her date of birth. She filed some false identity details, changed her date of birth, and she said she did this because female actresses were discriminated against above a certain age, and she wanted to present herself as younger. Very topical, I think, because just this morning, the TV in the US were talking about the actual lack of actresses who look old. Apparently, some directors have been saying that many Hollywood actresses of a certain age have had so much done to their faces and bodies in terms of surgery that some directors apparently are struggling to get, you know, 60-year-old actresses that look 60 these days. But that's a whole other debate, and we probably oughtn't to go there. But anyhow, in her case...
I'm ready to go there, actually.
But in her case, apparently she wanted to appear younger, filed a number of false documents, and subscribed to the IMDb site. What then happened is she then asked IMDb to remove her date of birth from her profile altogether. And then IMDb took it upon itself to investigate her request using publicly available information, posted her true date of birth, and now she's suing them because I think her case is that she has lost roles because of people knowing her true date of birth, and they now think that she's too old for the roles that they had in mind for her. And why I say it's reached a similar conclusion as to European courts is that IMDb's defense is that she signed up for their terms and conditions, and the terms and conditions included a clause saying that if there was litigation arising from the subscription, damages would be limited to the amount that the subscriber had paid in subscription fees. And the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Washington ruled on March 18th that that was not necessarily the case, and that the term limiting the subscriber's damages to the amount paid for the service was unconscionable because it was one-sided and effectively eliminated the subscriber's ability to recover anything other than what were effectively trivial damages in the amount of a contract breach. So the courts, it seemed, haven't necessarily said that the case is at an end and they have, you know, there are parts of the judgment which favour the actress and parts which favour IMDb, and clearly the case is going to run and run. But it seems to me that that was almost a European result. In Europe, when we have online terms that are business to consumer rather than business to business, there is an obligation on the provider of the site to make sure that the contract is balanced between the subscriber and the site owner. And I've had over the years a number of cases on this. You can get regulators intervening, and indeed I've had that, where terms and conditions were said by the regulator to be so one-sided that they were unlawful. And in certain cases, even criminal proceedings can result if it is felt that the terms and conditions favor the website too much rather than the consumer. And I guess my question to you, Eric, is am I right in reading into this that at least the Western District of Washington is coming over to the European model, or is this very much a case that, I guess as we lawyers say, turns on its own particular facts?
Yeah, great question, Jonathan, and thank you for diving into U.S. law. Very admirable. I can't comment as you can so much on the EU, but I can sort of put this in U.S. perspective, if you will, and having practiced here for, Lord knows, almost 30 years, I have seen many cases where courts don't find that, contractual terms have to be relatively balanced. The real point is, as long as there was, a true meeting of the minds, and there was what we call consideration, there was at least some value for each side in a contract, that the terms potentially can be upheld so long as there hasn't been fraudulent inducement or some sort of true mistake and misunderstanding. So I've seen situations, for example, in some sort of a software agreement where somebody's one side's providing software to the other, and the agreement reads, by the way, if something goes awry and you sue the software provider, the most you can get is the purchase price for the software. And sometimes potential damages when you have a software defect situation, the potential damages can be astronomical. And if your only remedy potentially is what you paid for the software, that's so much less than the true harm. And I've seen those clauses upheld. In fact, I've been the attorney that's helped to uphold those clauses in certain circumstances. And so often here, the best way to get around that, if you're on the other side, is to argue somehow there is fraudulent inducement, that you, when you entered into the contract, weren't fully apprised of the risks or the capabilities of the other side. And so you would never have agreed to that limitation if you had known that there was a true possibility of substantial harm that would be caused to you. It'll be interesting to see over time if this particular decision has any traction. I mean, this is a decision from a federal trial court in the Western District of Washington. What precedential value does it have? Not much. It's not a court of appeal decision from a federal circuit. It's not the United States Supreme Court. It might have persuasive influence over other judges in the Western District of Washington and other trial judges around the country that might look to it to find it potentially illuminating. But the real question is this any kind of harbinger of sentiment of other judges in the future? And we don't know yet, but we'll see.
Yeah, interesting. So I guess it's a watch this space, is it? And we'll see how this case develops. But it's an interesting fact pattern, isn't it? And it'll be interesting to see if it does lead to some development of the law. Both parties, from the looks of it, look quite well-funded, and it looks like a case that might well make it along to trial.
Yeah. Now, one thing I will point out is, you can have a problem where you seek to substantially limit potential damages and also seek to have what's called a class action waiver. Because at that point, if the damages are going to be extremely low based on agreement, and then you can't even mount a class action, so you can put forth a number of claims on behalf of a class of people, then effectively you're getting rid of any real remedy at all, even if you have a generalized problem. And I do believe the courts already here are against that. So that being said, I encourage you to enjoy my hometown of Washington, D.C. Jonathan, I hope the cherry blossoms start blooming this weekend. This has been your weekly Tech Law 10. I'm Eric Sinrod, EJ Sinrod at DwayneMorris.com. You can find us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter. In fact, Jonathan, you want to tell us about your Twitter photo of the week?
Yeah, you're welcome to look at my Twitter profile at ArmstrongJP. Let me know what you think of the photograph in particular, which those of you will see follows the Washington theme. Do connect with us on LinkedIn. I'll try and post the details of that case for anyone who wants to pull up the transcript and have another look at it. And yeah, thank you for the welcome to Washington. It's gorgeous weather, if a little cold here at the moment. And I'm looking forward to standing in for Obama for another 2 days, and then I'm back in the UK next week. So thanks for listening, and we'll speak to you again next week.
Cheers.
Bye now.